It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the challenges of implementing health insurance exchanges in Wisconsin under the Affordable Care Act. We'll also be talking with an organization that is out to encourage diversity in children's books. And remember, we're just getting rolling with our Curious Wisconsin segment, where we take on your most burning questions about the things you wonder about here in the Badger State. It's wide open. We can talk about history, street art, business, or whatever you like. You ask it, we'll try to answer it. Just head to our Facebook page and leave us a message.
And now we take a trip to Broadway. Nathaniel Stampley was born and raised in the Milwaukee area, and he's gone on to a big career in New York's musical theater scene. He's performed with Disney's production of The Lion King on Broadway and ended the run playing the leading role of Mufasa. And since then, he's appeared on Broadway again, this time in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. And he'll join the Broadway touring company in the title role of Porgy in the fall. Nathaniel Stampley, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm very happy to be here.
Well, and it's even more exciting to have you with us because you are from Milwaukee. Now, that can seem like a pretty long way from the lights of Broadway. And did you always know growing up that you wanted to perform on Broadway, that that's where you wanted to end up?
Not necessarily. I always knew that I would be in front of people performing in some capacity. My father is still a pastor there in Milwaukee. And so from the time I was a little kid, I've always been singing, in front of audiences and congregations. So I always knew that that would be a part of my life, but I wasn't quite sure that it would be Broadway. So that's pretty cool.
You mentioned that your father is a minister in Milwaukee, and I read that your mother is or was a music teacher. And I can only imagine that that might have had something to do with where you ended up.
Oh, my mom is incredible. I feel like I'm having the career that she would have had if she wouldn't have had, you know, six kids. but so she's incredible. I mean, you know, I got to hear her sing growing up, and she was our church organist and pianist. And so she was really influential in introducing me to a lot of different forms of music, and also my love for public radio as well.
Ah, well, we owe your mama thanks for that then. Well, I've read, I don't know if this is true, but as someone who was training to be a musician herself, that you have to practice something like 10,000 hours, which is, by the way, 10 years, to become truly excellent at something, to approach that sort of genius level. Did your mom make you practice? Is that part of it? Did she help you clock those 10,000 hours?
Well, I'm sure it was done in a sly way. I mean, we were always in church, and so we were always singing. And when your father is the pastor of a church, it's hard to say no if he calls you for a solo. So, and also, like, my grandmother, she used to sing a lot in church. So I really come from a great singing tradition in my family. And as far as the hours, I have no idea if that's true, but I do know that when you're an instant success, that's your 10 years right there. It takes 10 years to be, you know, an instant hit or a success.
Interesting. Well, I don't want to leave people in suspense. I want to give them a taste of your glorious voice. So can you sing something for us?
Oh, absolutely. This song is Couldn't Hear Nobody Pray, a spiritual that I used to sing with our concert choir at Whitefish Bay High School. And it's a song that's near and dear to my heart. And I couldn't hear nobody pray. Couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, way down yonder by myself. And I couldn't hear nobody pray in the valley. Couldn't hear nobody pray on my knees. Couldn't hear nobody pray with my burdens. Couldn't hear nobody pray. And my Savior, couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, Lord, I couldn't hear nobody pray.
couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, way down yonder by myself. And I couldn't hear nobody pray. Chilly waters, couldn't hear nobody pray. In the Jordan, couldn't hear nobody pray. In the valley, couldn't hear nobody pray. On my knees, couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, Lord, I couldn't hear nobody pray. Couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, way down yonder by myself. And I couldn't hear nobody pray.
That was so beautiful. Thank you so much.
Ah, you bet. Thank you.
When you sing something like this, which is a spiritual, does it mean something special to you, something extra? Is it, I guess, a form of worship as well as celebration of the voice?
Oh, absolutely. You know, my background and my faith is something that I carry with me everywhere I go. I feel like I wouldn't quite have the career that I have if I didn't have so many people praying for me all the time. So I'm grateful for all of those people that have come before me, and especially a wonderful tradition of spirituals in this country. It really means a lot, and I take it to heart everywhere I go.
We're talking with Broadway performer Nathaniel Stampley, who was born and raised here in Milwaukee. He'll tell us about the view from Pride Rock, what it was like playing Mufasa in The Lion King, and he's going to sing us one more song before we let him go. And we'll pick up that conversation after a check of the latest headlines. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll be talking about speculation that Milwaukee Brewers star Ryan Braun could face suspension after the All-Star Game on suspicions of doping. That's coming up in just a bit.
But first, we're talking with Milwaukee's own Nathaniel Stampley. Nathaniel grew up in the Milwaukee area. He studied voice at the UW-Madison, and he went on to have a big career in New York, where he played the leading role of Mufasa in Disney's The Lion King. And by the way, if you'd like to see a picture of Nate as Mufasa, you can head to the Central Time Facebook page and check that out there. He also recently performed in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess on Broadway. Moving to your Broadway career, your biggest role so far, I take it, has been playing Mufasa in The Lion King. You've played it on Broadway, at West End in London, and you toured as Mufasa across the United States. And as someone who's seen that show and has sat there absolutely slack-jawed at the pageantry and the music and the power, what was it like to be in the center of all of that?
Well, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. I would always tell everyone, for those that haven't seen the show, there's a rock that comes out of the stage floor, and Mufasa and Sarabi are the mother and father, the king and queen, and they're in the middle of this coronation of their new son, Simba. And you come onto the rock and you ascend to the top of Pride Rock, and it's the best seat in the whole theater. I mean, you see all the actors and dancers that are playing animals, and then you also get to see the entire house of the theater, and it's just so beautiful, and the music is incredible, and you know, you can see people wiping their tears away, and that is truly majestic.
Mm. Did you ever get used to it, or every night when you made that appearance on Pride Rock, did it take your breath away?
Pretty much every night. Every night, you know, the beauty of live theater is that, you know, it's never the same show. And so, you know, some night a giraffe is someone different, or, you know, a wildebeest is a little different that night. And the audience's responses are always different. So, you know, that part of it was always fresh and new. But I truly enjoyed that moment because it's such a royal moment. And in this country, we don't quite have royalty like overseas, but it's the closest that I got, at least.
That sounds like a pretty good feeling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, to have everyone bow to you. Are you kidding me?
I'll never know, but it sounds pretty great.
I'm bowing to you now, but you can't see me.
Well, thank you. I'll take your word for it. Usually, I guess, the role of Mufasa is played by guys who are older than you, who have been through a little bit more of life, of that life journey, when, at least when you started out. But I gather it was on this production that you met your wife, who was a dancer with the show, and you became a father during this. And did doing this role as Mufasa the Lion King, did that give you a new take on what it means to be someone who's mature, who's a father, who's the rock of some little person's life?
Yes. You know, when I initially started with the First National Tour, I was a Mufasa understudy. And so I was just a single guy on the show, met my wife, and everything changed. And then once I started doing the show on the West End in London, we were engaged. And then later on, you know, we were expecting our daughter, who's 4 and a half, and we, so all of these experiences truly changed what I did every night on stage. It wasn't just me acting. I would always put my daughter's face on the young Simbas that I would work with every night, and that really helped me every single night.
That's wonderful. Well, do you have any favorite memories of singing it that will just always stay with you?
I'll say, you know, there was one Sunday matinee that was really special for us in the Broadway company, where we were performing the show. Everything was, you know, a Sunday matinee. I think it was a 1 o'clock show that afternoon, and by intermission, we found out that Michael Jackson and his family and team of bodyguards were in the house.
Uh-huh.
And we were just so excited and just absolutely elated. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, here I am performing for one of my childhood idols. And, you know, and so that day was truly something special. And my wife and daughter just happened to be visiting me in between shows. So after the show, we all got to take photos together. So that was one day I'll never, ever forget.
Wait, you got to take photos with Michael Jackson?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Or I could say he got to take photos with my daughter.
I guess it depends on your perspective. But
that's right.
Well, so I got to ask, what was he like?
Oh, he wanted to meet all the company. He absolutely loved the show. And the one thing that I'll never forget was that he was a dad just like I was. Mm. And so he had the three children were there, and he was very protective of them, but was very much, you know, he wanted to make sure that, you know, they told us how much they enjoyed the show. Mm. So like any parent, he was sort of, you know, goading them along, like, come on, say hi. And I thought that was a moment that, you know, the rest of the world should have seen before he passed.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I know you're working now on Broadway again, and you're in the Broadway revival of Porgy and Bess by the Gershwins. What can you tell
Woo-hoo!
Us? Congratulations. Yeah, what can you tell us about that show?
Oh, my gosh. This is truly a theatrical just dream come true. I think, you know, a lot of people know a lot of the songs from the show. Ain't Necessarily So, Summertime, you know, the most recorded song in all of history. My Man's Gone Now. And so a lot of these songs are done out of the context of the opera. And so people know them from commercials or, you know, jazz arrangements like Miles Davis or even a Janis Joplin arrangement of Summertime. But, you know, to have all of these pieces in its, you know, true context in the theater, it's just amazing. I mean, the story is truly amazing. And we have an incredible cast. Our creative team really put something together that's truly special.
Well, it sounds amazing, and it looks amazing, the little bit that I've seen online. And do you feel like you're a different person having come through The Lion King now to be doing Porgy and Bess?
Well, you know, it's funny. This is, you know, this is a true, like, full circle for me. When I was in high school in Milwaukee, I auditioned for the Florentine Opera Company's production of Porgy and Bess. And so I was in the opera chorus and just was absolutely blown away by all of the singers and, you know, and the music. I mean, it's, you know, Gershwin's score is absolutely breathtaking. And so I was so excited to be in that show, and it has stayed with me forever. And that was my first professional gig. And now here we are many years later, you know, I get to do the show 8 times a week on Broadway, and I couldn't be happier. I couldn't be happier.
Well, I know we've been talking a lot about your kids, and the last song you want to sing for us is something that's special to them and to you. Tell us about that.
Well, this song is something that whenever the kids are down or a little upset about something, I just go right ahead and sing this song. And it always changes everyone's moods, and I love it. And if it's okay with you, I'll just do it right now.
Perfect.
So this one is real simple. Mr. Isaiah, Mr. Isaiah, hey, Mr.
That's Nathaniel
Isaiah,
Stampley, a Wisconsin performer who grew up in Milwaukee and went on to perform on Broadway. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in this week for Rob Ferret. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll be discussing a lack of diversity in children's books and what can be done about it.
But first, it seems like just yesterday that Milwaukee Brewers superstar Ryan Braun was on top of the world. But after winning the MVP award in 2011, he's been plagued with accusations of using performance-enhancing drugs.
And now the 5-time All-Star is reportedly not cooperating with a Major League Baseball investigation into a Florida-based firm which allegedly provided banned substances to Major League players. He could be facing a major suspension as a result.
And our next guest says this poses quite a dilemma for Brewers fans. Michael Hunt is a sports columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, Michael, catch us up on this investigation. What do we know so far?
Well, so far, all we know is that the reports by various outlets that Major League Baseball has enough evidence, and that after interviewing Braun in Pittsburgh a couple of weeks ago while the Brewers were playing there, that he did not answer questions, did not cooperate with Major League Baseball's investigators, and that the reports are that they're going to move ahead sometimes after the All-Star break with a 100-game suspension for his performance-enhancing drugs use.
Now, as far as Braun not answering questions, choosing not to cooperate, how do you read that?
I read it in totally in character with his approach has been since this kind of first hit more than 18 months ago. He has only made one emphatic statement. That was in spring training the year before last when he denied that he's ever used any kind of performance-enhancing drugs. And since then, his posture has been to not answer questions on any level. I think that's obviously it's the advice he's getting from his handlers, from his PR people out in California, and he's stuck to it. He's stuck to it with the media, he's stuck to it in public, and now he's sticking to it with Major League Baseball.
Now, it wasn't so long ago that he was let off the hook for a similar infraction, that time on a technicality. What do you think is going to happen this time as it unfolds?
I think Major League Baseball is going to be much more careful. Last time he got off, it, like you said, it was a technicality. It was a chain of evidence question where the sample got out of the hands of the investigators. And I don't think that's going to happen again. Whatever they have now, they're going to have solid evidence. They're going to move forward. And it looks like to me that they're going to go ahead and move forward with the suspension.
Now, the people of Milwaukee, they love their Ryan Braun. He is the golden boy. So this has got to be a touchy subject.
It is. It's an incredibly touchy subject because he's one of the few superstars who has pledged to spend his entire career in Milwaukee, and he has a contract that carries him through 2021. He'll be 37 or 38 years old at the time, which you would think would be at near the end or the end of his career. And he's made investments in the city as well. He has restaurants here. He's out in public a good bit. He's almost like he's one of us. And people here are fiercely protective of his image, but I think at some point, you know, they'll have to sit down and kind of figure this out in their own minds, whether or not that Braun's being honest and whether he's kind of worthy of the admiration.
Well, do you think, let's say, the evidence comes back looking not so good for Ryan Braun, are we going to be in a sort of Paula Deen scenario where people have to decide whether to forgive him and he has to decide whether to ask forgiveness and then we're in that whole soupy emotional mess?
You know, I don't think it's going to get to that level because I'm pretty sure that Braun, he's never going to waver. He's always going to hold the same posture that he is innocent on this. And yeah, I think around here, if he's suspended, it'll be for the rest of this season and for however long the 100-game suspension will last here. My thought is that he'll come back here in this particular city almost like nothing else, almost like it hadn't happened. Outside this area, he's going to take a hit, and it's a hit for the Brewers, too. It's an embarrassing situation. So, yeah, people will have to make up their minds whether or not they believe him.
Do you think that the MLB just has it out for Ryan Braun? He's one of these superstars. He evaded the net last time. Are they trying to get him this time?
Oh, yeah, I think that's a definite part of the story. As much as Braun may be guilty on this, I think for sure that Major League Baseball has been out to get him. It was really embarrassed when Braun became the first baseball player actually in the history of drug testing to get out of a positive drug test. And that was a huge embarrassment. And part of it, I don't think we can ignore the fact that the office of Major League Baseball is in Milwaukee. You know, Commissioner Selig is here. And it was an embarrassment to him. And the problem with that, he really likes Braun. I mean, you know, he former owner of the Brewers, he got to know him, but, you know, still he has to protect the integrity of the game. And it was a huge embarrassment to him when Braun was able to wiggle out on the technicality.
Now there's another one of these golden boys, big stars on the hook, just like Ryan Braun, Alex Rodriguez. How different is the situation for the two of them?
Well, it's different than Braun is kind of a regional sensation. Now he has a national profile that he was the National League Most Valuable Player in 2011, and he is a five-time All-Star, so he has a very high profile. But Rodriguez, you know, he plays for the Yankees, and that puts him in a whole different stratosphere with the media attention, with the world's attention. And that's one thing that might help Braun a little bit if the suspension goes forward, that most of the attention will be on A-Rod just because of his higher profile. And you know, Rodriguez has had problems over the years with a number of issues, so it's not like he has the squeaky clean image that Braun has had. So, you know, it'll be a little bit of a mitigating factor for Braun, I think.
you know, we can't go back in time, but, you know, if we could, there was the moment when the Brewers had to decide if they were going to give that big 5-year contract to Ryan Braun or their other superstar, Prince Fielder. They went with Braun. Do you think anyone's looking back at that and looking at all of these allegations that keep coming back after Ryan Braun and wondering about that decision?
I don't think so, because the Brewers did make a good faith offer to Prince Fielder. It was in the territory of the Braun contract, and Prince, he rejected it. He wasn't going to stay with the Brewers no matter what. He was gone. He was going to try to get as much money as he could, and this being a small market, he wasn't going to get it here. So, you know, that's a different, it's a different scenario when you talk about Braun, who actually took a below market contract. I know it sounds ridiculous to say that when his extension was something for about 10 years, $133 million, but by baseball standards, that is a below market contract. Both sides, it was mutually beneficial. Both sides are taking on some risk in this. Braun with not getting as much money if he has decided to go out and test his worth in the free market. And the Brewers, you know, if he gets hurt or can't fulfill his contract for any other reason. But no, I don't see any parallels at all with the Prince Fielder situation.
Well, Michael, we're about out of time, but best case scenario, how does this unfold for Ryan Braun?
Well, best case scenario is he somehow slips off again like he did the first time around, but I just don't see that happening. I just see Major League Baseball going forward with this. So the best case scenario for him is he lays low for these 100 games. He takes the punishment. He comes back, and hopefully, you know, he'll talk about it then. I don't expect that to happen, but I think that would be the best thing for him to explain this sometimes next year when this is all finished.
And as far as the Brewers themselves, Ryan Braun is the big star. Looking forward, is there someone else? You said he's going to be 37, 38 at the time his contract with the Brewers is done. Is there someone else who's ready to step up?
Yeah, they have two excellent players. The two guys who made the All-Star team, Gene Segura and Carlos Gomez, those are going to be two very high-profile, very productive players. And the Brewers have them under contract for a long time because they're young players. And they're not Ryan Braun. Now, make no mistake about that. Braun is his kind of talent only comes around, you know, once every 50 years in Major League Baseball. Nobody the Brewers have or many other teams can compare to him. But at least they do have some nice young talent. Now all they got to do now is go out and get some pitching.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to keep on watching this, and I'm betting you will too.
Yes, I will. Thanks for having me on.
That was Michael Hunt, sports columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've got a link to his piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the lack of diversity in children's books.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. And this is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're going to be talking about children's books for the next few minutes here on Central Time. We'd originally booked a segment on diversity in children's books and having some trouble getting through to our guests, so we'll work on that and then work on replanning that segment for you. In the meantime, though, we thought this would be a good opportunity for us to take a moment and talk about some of the children's books that we love and some of the children's books that may have influenced you. You know, when you were a kid, maybe your parents read it to you, or maybe you discovered it all on your own, but what was the book that really stuck with you? What was a book that all these years later you still remember, that you're still influenced by? Veronica, what comes to mind for you?
You know, I was thinking recently about Little Women.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when I still have this beautiful, someone had gotten me a beautiful leather-bound copy of this book. And it's just so evocative, the quiet lives they led in New England. And there's nothing flashy about it. There's no pyrotechnics. There's no magic. But it's just a gentle, beautiful book about sisters, the March sisters, trying to find their way in the world. And I haven't read that one to my kids yet. I think that's one that I need to get going on. But we'd love to hear what your favorite children's book is. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1061. 1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also go ahead and post on the Central Time Facebook page. And maybe there's a book that you love that you would read even without your children. Maybe your children have up and left the nest, but you still go back to this book. I think Little Women is a book like that for me. What about for you?
Little Women is not a book like that for me, unfortunately, but having said that, there are lots of books that influenced me greatly. Wind in the Willows, of course, was a big influence on me. My grandmother gave it to me when I was 7, and it was just a terrific book, and I still remember Mr. Toad's Wild Ride.
And you probably relate to Mr. Toad, I bet. You ride motorcycles.
I do.
It shaped your life.
It was a wild ride. And you know, the interesting thing about Wind in the Willows, years later, listening to a Pink Floyd album, of all things, Piper at the Gates of Dawn.
Blank stare.
From Wind in the Willows.
Really?
A Pink Floyd song, yeah. So there you go. They were influenced by it, too. So lots of people would like to talk about this, and we'll be taking calls in just a second. But, you know, it's such a personal thing, books like this. So here's a Purcell family favorite. At my grandma's house, all my dad's old children's books were lying about, and one of them was called Safe at Home with the Happies.
Safe at Home with the Happies.
And it was a book on safety around the house, like don't light the gas stove and things like that. And so we still recite all those things today. Safe at Home. I've never seen it before or since. So Safe at Home with the Happies is another one. And another more recent addition to the Purcell legacy is, it's for smaller children, but it's called Dry Pants Feel Great.
I can't argue with that.
Nope, I can't either. But I'll tell you what, it makes the whole issue of toilet training good, and it is also a theme that I think we can all agree with. Dry pants feel great. I recommend it tremendously. So, Veronica, how about we take some calls?
Let's take a call. Let's go to Maddie in Madison. Hi, Maddie.
Hi.
Hi. What's your favorite children's book?
Well, I actually have an author. Her name is Tamara Pierce, and she writes awesome, awesome books about female heroines, and she talks and each of her series addresses some different type of either race issue, social issue, economic issue. Her books are really fabulous, and the target audience is young adults, like 10 to 12 year olds, and they're still relevant. I'm 22 years old and a college student, and they're still fabulous.
Oh, I haven't heard. Tamara Pierce is the name of that author, right?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We appreciate it, Maddie. And we'll go next to Lee in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I don't have any big classical book. I have a children's book that was, a golden book called Bad Mousy. And it was really a moralistic story told in kind of a gruesome way with a mouse that was always in trouble. And Monica was always having to get him out of trouble with Mother, and Mother was so mad that she put him on an umbrella out in the storm so he'd blow far, far away. But Mommy was so surprised that when he came back, time after time, finally Monica taught him how to be a good mousy. And I think that really tells us a lot about crime and punishment doesn't really work, but educating and training people really do. Lifetime.
Yeah, there are some really great books in those little golden books. And Bad Mousy, one of your favorites. Thank you so much, Lee. Appreciate that. And it looks as though we have been successful in getting our guest on the line. And we will talk now with Kyle Zimmer. He is president and CEO of First Book, an organization dedicated to providing access to books for children in need.
Kyle
Zimmer. Hi there.
Hi, Kyle Zimmer. This is Gene Purcell with Central Time. Thanks for joining us, and sorry about the trouble getting on the line.
I apologize for the complication, but I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, we've been talking about some favorite children's books here, and one of the topics we wanted to talk with you about was the whole issue of diversity in children's books, and this is an industry that you've been affiliated with for some time. When did this first become apparent to you that the lack of diversity is an issue to be concerned about?
Well, you know, people have been, including me, have been worried about the lack of diversity for decades and decades. So this it actually is not a new topic. And in fact, there's some evidence that suggests that we were better in our focus and reality of diversity in children's books a couple of decades back, and that, in fact, we've gotten worse.
Well, what happened?
Well, I think that there's not a grand conspiracy. I don't think anybody is misbehaving. I think what has happened is there are a lot of pressures on publishers these days. And what has happened is the market for example, the average cost of a premium picture book for a child in the U.S. today is about $18. And so when you look at that price point, what you realize is that that really constricts their market to the upper 10%, maybe 15% of the socioeconomic strata in the U.S. And what happens is publishers get very, very conservative about what that market is interested in and what that market will bear. And they make very, very conservative decisions. And what that does, unfortunately, is it leaves the children in the lower 30% of the U.S. socioeconomics completely off the table because those families can't afford $18 picture books, and the books are less and less relevant to their lives and their cultures.
So you're president and CEO of First Book, which is an organization dedicated to providing access to books for children in need. So tell me a little bit, if you would, about those children in that lower 30%.
Well, it's a lot of the headlines that we all have read in our communities and also at the national level for a long, long time. We know that kids in need are the literacy rates are flagging. We know that we have not yet cracked the access issue. And so even though First Book has put 100 million books into schools and programs around the country, we know that some of the data shows that in the most impoverished areas and neighborhoods in the country, we're talking about one book for every 300 children. So, you know, we shouldn't really be surprised when we know that data shows that ready access to high-quality books is an essential element to kids learning to read and learning to love to read. But and then we marry that with the fact that we've got these just chasms of need in the lower 30% where kids just don't have access. Books aren't part of their lives.
So is there a market? We talked a little bit before about some of the pressures facing book publishers these days, and even in the children's book market. Is there a market for diversity in children's literature?
I think there's a huge market for diversity in children's books, and that's why First Book has launched a project called Stories for All. What we believe is that, if you look even at the most conservative estimates in the U.S., there are about 1.2 million programs and classrooms serving children in need across the country. And these are a huge range of programs. They can be in church basements, in homeless shelters, in traditional classrooms. And that 1.2 million, you know, some of them are programs with 8 kids, and some of them are schools serving, 2,000 kids. So they vary. They're all over the map. They're urban. They're rural. And they represent the fullest diversity of cultures in our country. And not only is that market hungry for books that speak to them, but also, we're robbing families who are more affluent of the diversity that their children need to understand and appreciate when they step out into the world. So it's not good for anyone.
So in about 30 seconds or so, you're optimistic that something's going to happen in this regard, that we will see more diversity?
This is why I'm optimistic. We have launched this program called Stories for All. It's a market-driven model. We've already laid millions of dollars on the table to show the publishers that there's a ready market that needs access and wants access. And so, and the publishers have responded very strongly. We had 24 major publishers stand up and engage with us when we launched our project. So I think it's there, and I think they're ready to do it, and I'm very excited about the future.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. Kyle Zimmer, President and CEO of First Book.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.